the Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Ewan McElraith from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. Joining me for a rather unusual Scotland Outdoors Podcast, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, we're at Platform 3 on Waverley Station beside the train that's going to take us from Edinburgh down to Stow in the Borders.
Ewan and I are not alone. Our guest today is rail expert David Spavin. David's got a new book out called Scotland's Lost Branch Lines. What's the dog called, by the way?
Rudy. He's a cross between a spaniel and a border collie. Very appropriate as we're heading to the borders.
Given the cross, he's remarkably well behaved.
So far.
So far, so good. Look, let's just get seats and we'll get ourselves organised and we'll take it from there. He likes looking out the window, does he?
He loves trains, he loves buses, he hates cars.
All right.
Nobody objects to that.
I don't. I'm much the same myself.
How extensive was the rail network in Scotland once upon a time?
There were over 3,000 miles of rail network in Scotland if you go back to the 1950s. But of course, the big change came in the early to mid 60s when Dr. Beeching's axe took out every branch line in Scotland and indeed some main lines. And what we're travelling on today, down to Stow en route to Gala and Tweed Bank, was the Waverley route, which was a main line. It was the worst of the Beeching cuts. 98 miles closed 5th January 1969. Left Gala, Shields and Hawick as the biggest towns of their size anywhere in Britain without a rail connection.
In proposing the closing down of stations and services, we are only recommending the continuation of a process that's gone on for some time.
This is a branch line now. Just define a branch line, because that's what we're concentrating on and its relationship with rural Scotland.
It's a very interesting question. It's one that I wrestled with when I was starting researching this book. What exactly is a branch line? And I couldn't really find a very easy definition. But essentially, it's a line that leads from a cross-country route or a main line to a terminus. So it's a dead end, if you like. And typically, if you go back in Scotland's history to Victorian, Edwardian times, it was less than 20 miles long, often single track as well.
Beeching, Dr. Beeching came along in the 1960s. He was asked to actually look at the viability of the rail network. And he did it very much as a businessman would. He looked at, you know, is it profitable or otherwise? Were these branch lines ever really profitable?
Well, that's a very interesting point, Mark, because certainly looking at some of my researches, some of them should never have been built in the first place. But there's also the question, you know, what do you mean by profitability? What's a railway for? Is it for social and economic benefit? Is it nowadays, particularly for environmental benefit? So viability can mean a lot of different things, but certainly a good number of the branch lines which I investigated for the book, which were closed in the 60s, could just about have covered their operating costs. So a terrible loss, and a loss of something that was definitely viable in the broadest sense.
The railways, for many years now, have been losing traffic to road vehicles, to the private car, to the bus and to the lorry. And this closure of services is a necessary part, or at least a necessary accompaniment, of the other process of building up the good parts of the railway, those parts that carry nearly all the traffic now.
But there was also a committee set up before Beeching brought out his report, looking into the viability and, you know, assessing the possibility of something happening. Suggestion that wasn't a consultation, it was a decision-making machine, and there were some very odd folk on that committee. It wasn't your average working-class guy.
No, these committees in the 50s, and to a lesser degree in the 60s, were kind of stuffed with people with OBEs or CBEs. You know, it was very much the establishment, very few women, and the worst example of the lot is in the case of the closure of the line to Peebles, because a member of the committee was the high hegian from Scottish Omnibuses. And here's a guy who would benefit from the railway closing because his buses would get busier. And yet he was instrumental in closing the railway to people. So there was some pretty shocking things went on then.
You're saying that, you know, when that decision was taken, the guy was openly jubilant.
Yeah, he said, I wasn't in favour of dieselising all these routes when they were steam. They should just have shut, and they should shut now. They introduced diesel multiple units, a bit like what we're travelling on now in 1958, but they didn't speed up the service compared to when it was steam hauled. And the fares could be pretty rigid, you know, when you couldn't get cheap day returns like so easily as you can nowadays. So there were a lot of things that could have been done, both on the supply side, if you like, and on the demand side to make it more attractive, you know, to stimulate more tourist traffic, for example. And certainly, you know, as today we are heading down to the borders, a lot of people go down in the train to the borders now for a day trip, you know, whether they're going to Sir Walter Scott's Abbotsford or they're taking a walk along the Tweed to Melrose. There's so much to do. And again, there was a kind of blind eye turned to all that.
Give me a sense of the kind of places that used to be served by branch lines in Scotland.
Well, there were so many, the length and breadth of the country, for example, Fraserburgh and Peterhead, which are now, for their size, they're further from the rail network than anywhere else in Britain, you know, following the opening of the Borders Railway. Then you've got the Deeside line through the likes of Banchory to Ballater. Callander used to have a railway. Crieff used to have a railway. We could go on a long time listing all the places that have lost their trains.
I'm fairly certain I can remember getting a steam train from, as a very, very small child, steam train from Aberdeen to Fraserburgh.
Aberdeen to Fraserburgh was a classic example of where the line could have been saved quite readily. They used some of the most unreliable diesel locomotives to be introduced in the 1950s there. Often had breakdowns. They didn't introduce diesel units, which would have cut costs. They didn't do enough to stimulate travel. There were only five trains a day.
This train is for Tweedbank. This train will call at Bruxton, New Craig Hall, Shawfair, Eskbank, Newton Grange, Gore Bridge, Stow, Gala Shields, and Tweedbank. The next stop is Bruxton. Passenger safety information notices are located throughout this train.
In the country areas, it's doubtful whether the railways carry as much as 10% of the traffic that there is. Nearly all the rail services which we intend to cut out run parallel with bus services. And even where they don't, it's very much cheaper to run a bus instead of the railway. And therefore, if there is a social need for some minimum level of service, it's really much better to provide it by bus. It's the bus stations in many parts of the country that are busy, not the country railway station.
How did people react when they were told, actually, your branch line's going to close?
It was very variable, Mark. In some cases, there was a really spirited resistance to the closure, and sometimes aided by the trade unions, although the record of the trade unions was actually very, very patchy in terms of the beaching acts. But, you know, if you look at some of the research that was done, not by me, but about 40 years ago, an academic report was done for BR looking at the impact of rural closures. And what came out of the interviews they did was a lot of people felt the whole thing was a fait accompli. That yes, supposedly there was a committee, the Transport Users Consultative Committee, which would advise on hardship. But I think a lot of folk just felt they've already decided they're going to close, so why bother? So there was quite a lot of apathy in a way.
You quote a local minister who basically makes the case for beaching, saying, yeah, we were very, very sad that it had disappeared, but most of us had cars anyway. But a lot of people didn't have cars back then.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, it's still the case today. It's about a third of the households in Scotland don't have access to a car. That's not very well known. But it was a much higher proportion back then. But there was just a feeling, you know, oil was cheap. The car was the way forward. That's what had happened in America. You know, too often we sort of slavishly follow what happens in America. Although some of the campaigners, for example, in Deeside said, well, wait a minute. The American experiment is not necessarily completely successful because look what it's doing to, in terms of congestion, the inner city, etc. We shouldn't go down that road, but we went down that road.
What was the impact, kind of financial, economic impact in some of these rural areas that suddenly found they were cut off completely, you know, 2 or 3 hours drive away?
Well, you know, there's not been an awful lot of research done about that, but an academic paper was produced about 4 years ago, which suggested those areas which had lost their trains performed economically significantly more poorly than those areas which had retained their trains. At the time, I think the feeling was, well, the road's the way forward, you know, as you see, most people, quote unquote, have got cars. But no, there were economic impacts that were not properly understood. And if they were understood, they were kind of swept to one side.
There's a quote here in your book from a businessman in Ballyhooly saying, when the train came in, you met people. The link was a link with the outside world and it kept us alive. Now the contact is broken and the place is dead. I mean, that's kind of chilling.
It is chilling, and you know, it's partly a psychological impact, and it's very interesting, you know, 30 or 40 years on from these sort of sentiments being expressed, this idea of getting on the map and being linked in was a key driver for the Borders Railway that we're now travelling on. We want to be on the map, we want to be recognisable. Very sensibly, the new railway was called the Borders Railway, so it said, oh, let's go to the borders. And that's brought economic benefits as well as social benefits and environmental benefits.
I actually followed the campaign for the Borders Railway, and then its construction and what the figures were. Off the top of my head, I could be wrong here, I think they estimated 650,000 passenger journeys in the first year. It was something like 21 million. Now, that to me suggests either there's something very wrong with the way they're trying to calculate what the likely impact is going to be, or there is still a serious prejudice there.
This is a long-running complaint. Many of the lines and the stations that have been reopened have done far, far better than the original forecast. And in the case of the border stations, in the first year, the traffic was more than 300% higher than forecast. So utterly pessimistic forecast, which mean there are other branch lines out there which, you know, have got a good case, but, you know, the quote-unquote business case says, no, it doesn't stack up.
Thank you.
Cool.
Cheers, thanks. Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you, cheers.
What might have been an advantage back in 1969 in terms of car journeys is not an advantage now because it's much, much more congested.
Yes, certainly. And I came across various examples of the trade unions, for example, saying, well, look, you know, road congestion is going to get worse. It's going to be more difficult to get into the centre of Dundee from St Andrews. You know, OK, we've got the new Tay Road Bridge, but that's going to fill up with traffic. The same was said about the Aberdeen-Fraserburgh line, that traffic congestion in Aberdeen is going to get worse. The train avoids all this congestion. But together with all these wider, more subtle arguments, it was just thrown out.
Is there the potential? I mean, the Borders Railway proves there is potential. But most of the stations that have been opened have just been stations that are on main lines anyway. They're not branch lines.
Yes, the vast majority of stations that have opened in Scotland, and there have been many over the last 25, 30 years, the vast majority have been on existing lines. Obviously, if you build a new line, you've got a number of problems. I mean, classically in this country, when a line was closed in the 60s, the line of route was not protected against development, as happens, for example, in the likes of France and I think parts of the USA, that the corridor is protected for future possibilities for transport. That didn't happen here. So, you know, on the Borders Railway, we were getting out at Stow. The council allowed a bungalow to be built on the site of the station. Absolutely bizarre. So, absolutely classic British outlook, short-termism, no strategic vision.
So when they reopened this line, they had to knock the bungalow down, presumably.
Yeah, and guess who one of the biggest objectors to the new railway was?
Wild shot in the dark.
It's not often you'll hear me say this, but Aberdeenshire Council, Grampian Regional Council, as was then, were actually a bit of foresight in terms of protecting that route.
That's one of the good examples from Aberdeen and Dyce to Fraserburgh and Peterhead, that Grampian Regional Council, sadly no longer existing, took a strategic view. I mean, they had responsibilities for transport and planning, and so they protected the line of route, which is now a walkway and a cycle route, other than one or two places where bridges were taken out to improve sight lines for motorists, but makes it so much easier to get a railway reopened in the future if it's been strategically protected, which didn't happen with the Borders Railway. And the consultants actually told me when I was campaigning that the fact that the line of route of the Borders Railway had not been protected had added 40% to the cost of the new railway.
Whose idea was it to reinstate the Borders Railway?
Basically, it was a grassroots campaign. If you go back to the early 1990s, the local politicians, the MPs, before we had a Scottish Parliament, basically, they were all dismissive of the idea, saying, oh, it's a tragedy, we lost our railway, but it'll never come back. But grassroots campaigners got together and formed the campaign for Borders Rail in the early to mid-1990s. And then in the late 1990s, the campaign for Borders Rail was specifically set up. And that drove really hard. And, you know, the political and civil service establishment, a lot of them fought really hard against this railway being reopened.
Why?
Because they felt it would be a white elephant. They couldn't see the case for it. How would it stack up? They'd got consultants in to do projections which suggested you'd only get a handful of passengers. But, you know, as we've seen, the consultants got it seriously wrong. So there was a strong wish to try and stop the railway being built. But the grassroots campaigners kept plugging away, and eventually the penny started dropping. And there's no doubt that the existence of the Scottish Parliament made a big difference, because there was a body with the purse strings that was close to the borders. They were looking for projects to take on board. A lot of money was flowing into Scotland from Westminster to help devolution work. So a lot of things came together, but very much a grassroots campaign.
Is that kind of dried up now, that desire for reopening branch lines?
We're beginning to see a number of reopenings now, including the Borders Railway, the line to Alloa, for example. And now we're going to have the line to Leavenmouth reopened. And that's the biggest continuous built-up area in Scotland without a railway. And an area that's suffered economically. So at long last, the Scottish Government's backing the reopening there, and that'll happen in the next couple of years. But, you know, we're seeing resistance to getting the line reopened to St Andrews. We're seeing resistance to getting the line pushed back into Buchan. I mean, I think with the best will in the world, the railway's never going to get back to Banff, but I could see it getting into Buchan, maybe to Fraserburgh and Peterhead, which are very populous places. But it's not even just a matter of reopening the railways. We've got this deregulated, disintegrated system here where, you know, on the continent you would find the bus turned up at the railway station and everything connected together and through fares. We've still got this daft, deregulated system here. So, for example, in the case of Banff or Buckie, you know, we should be seeing a bus service feeding into the railway. But now, 40 years after the railway to Buckie closed, there's no longer a bus service from Buckie to the nearest railhead at Keith's.
Well, so you don't need massive track. You don't need huge trains. You can go light, as one of the options were 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, that's very much the case. And one of the options for the future, something that was pioneered in Germany called the tram train. A tram that runs on the street in the centre of the city or a town, and then once it gets out of town, it goes on to the mainline network, so it can operate on both. I mean, been very successful. And that's something, for example, that could apply perhaps from Aberdeen to Bankery. So you get around some of the obstructions more easily, because a tram train could go up steeper gradients and go around sharper curves. There's lots of scope for doing things like that, but, you know, the progress in Scotland and this sort of thing is so painfully slow.
You mentioned a piece of research that was done back in the 1980s, 1984 I think it was, and it was looking at the social impact of these closures in a way that Beeching really hadn't. Beeching looked at the economic impact of it, wasn't particularly interested in the social impact. There were dire predictions, you know, of, well, when we lose the line, that'll be it, the place will be gutted, it'll be gone. Were those actually borne out?
Well, it's an interesting point, because some of the predictions that were made were real doom-mongering. You know, this is the end, this is our coffin. And, you know, if you look at, for example, somewhere like St Andrews, St Andrews has prospered both in terms of education and golf and holidays, etc., despite not having a railway. And you can look at that and say, well, nowadays there's a pretty good interchange at Lookers on the main line from Edinburgh to Dundee, and if you go to the bus station at St Andrews, it shows you the train times as well, you can get through tickets. So sometimes things have not worked out as badly as feared, but in other cases you look at perhaps a place like Crieff, which, you know, has not been doing terribly well, and yet if it had been on the railway, I don't have any doubt that it would now have a regular train service right the way through to Glasgow, and what a difference that would have made.
One of the success stories, one of the branch lines that didn't get shut down, was North Berwick. Why did it escape, and why is it such an example of what you can do?
It's a very, very good point, Ewan. I think the campaigners in North Berwick learnt the lessons of other closures which went wrong, where the campaigners hadn't really got their act together properly. They implicitly said, look, we'll accept a reduction in the level of service provided you keep some trains. So the train service went down from a dozen a day to three, but still preserved that essential commute. I think it also has to be said there were quite a lot of movers and shakers in North Berwick. And I'll never forget reading a statement from Ernest Marples, the infamous transport minister back in the Beeching era, who was talking about, you know, we will take account of the economic factors, the social factors, the hardship factors in reaching a decision. The one thing that he didn't say was, we will take account of the political factors. And that, for example, is what saved the hundreds of miles of railway north and west of Inverness to Wigan, Thurso and Kyle McGulch. Massive campaign, and the Conservative government could see the writing on the wall that if they didn't reprieve these routes, they were politically going to be in big trouble. They were in big trouble anyway, and they lost the next general election. But, you know, politics is key to all this. It still is nowadays.
We touched on the negative impact of branch closures. Let's talk about the positives of actually reopening the Borders Railway. What impact do you feel it's actually had on communities south of Edinburgh?
Well, it's made it feasible to live in the Borders more readily and commute into Edinburgh without having a car. It's brought new businesses into the Borders and new attractions like the Tapestry of Scotland and Gala Shields, and Tweed Bank is expanding. It just makes it a lot easier to go up to Edinburgh, you know, whether it's for education or shopping. And that's one of the big things, is access to education. So somebody can still stay in the Borders, they can come up to college in Edinburgh and go home at night, rather than having to shift away permanently. And that was one of the things that came out in the study in the 1980s, that some folk just had to move away from the corridors where the branch line had existed because they couldn't get access to education.
Possibility of that, pushing it through to Carlisle, because that would give a whole new route into Scotland or to England.
The cynics say...
England wouldn't be cut off anymore.
True. The cynics say that we don't need another through route because post-pandemic there's been a bit of a decline in rail travel, and therefore we've got three existing routes to England and that's enough. Campaign for Borders Rail, which has mounted a really strong campaign, is emphasising the linkages cross-border between Cumbria, Dumfries and Galloway and the Borders, the option of alternative routes. You could have, for example, a train that starts in Edinburgh, calls Gala Shields, Hawick, Newcastleton, Longtown, Carlisle, carries on through to Liverpool or Manchester, opening up all kinds of new links that don't exist at the moment. I mean, it is difficult because the costs that face you pushing the railway on, but the reality is that Hawick is the town which has suffered worst from the loss of the Waverley route back in 1969. Its population has been in continuous decline, whereas Gala Shields has been on the up, and Gala Shields is now on the railway. And Hawick would benefit enormously from a reopened railway, put it on the map.
This is something you're obviously deeply passionate about. What would you like to see in terms of an integrated transport network across Scotland?
I would like to see, ideally, something like the system in Switzerland, where everything links together, right down to local post buses. So the whole thing's seamless. You don't have to deal with different operators. You don't have to buy separate tickets. You don't have to consult separate timetables. I'd love to see that here. I think deregulation has been a costly mistake in terms of wider social and economic benefit. Yes, companies have made a profit out of it, but it's not been good for public transport. So ideally, I'd like to see an integrated system within which an expanded rail network would play an absolutely key part. But you can't go everywhere with a new railway. But provided you've got that integrated coach link, then you can see the whole thing as a seamless public transport network.
Climate emergency aside, as we sit here, you know, as we're recording this, I think Brent crude's coming in at $110 a barrel, something like that. You know, Ed, a couple of days ago in Aberdeen, one filling station on King Street was $194 a litre. The cost of using fuel in private vehicles is going to skyrocket. I mean, it seems to be heading in that direction. So to have a rail network that actually gives people a viable option would seem to be a good thing.
Very much so. And I mean, railways in any shape or form are more energy efficient and more carbon friendly than doing things by road. So what we really need is the electrification of our railways, and that's been progressing, but you know, it's been pretty painfully slow other than in the Central Belt Corridor. And we've got a situation now where the railway to Inverness and the railway to Aberdeen, they're not going to be electrified until 2035. It's a long way away. And meantime, you know, the A9 is still being dualled. There's plans to dual the whole of the A96. The whole thing's out of kilter, and the First Minister has rightly acknowledged the climate emergency, but the policies and the programmes and the projects to respond to that are not in place. You know, the road engineers still hold very strong sway in Scotland. I don't see any silver bullets out there, but the politics are very strong. And, you know, as somebody who's been campaigning about what we now call sustainable transport since he was a late teenager, I'm nearly 70 now, and I sometimes despair that we're still going over the same old arguments about the impact of the car, and okay, if you get an electric vehicle, that helps the climate emergency a bit, but you've still got to get precious metals, you've got the issue of the car causing deaths and injuries, you've got the dislocation it causes, the noise. Politically, this is so difficult, and it's this conflict between personal choice and consumerism on the one hand, and the wider public benefit and a strategic view on the other hand. And I do sometimes wonder how we're going to be able to deliver this politically, because there's some hard choices out there. And are people willing to be confronted with hard choices? I don't know.
How long did you work for the railways?
18 years in total. I started out when I was actually a student during my student holidays up in Invergordon and Tain in the days when the aluminium smelter was booming. And I got a real taste for working on the railway. Then ultimately became a management trainee, and I spent a couple of decades as a freight marketing manager in London and Glasgow. I went in partly because I had a sense of public service. You know, the railway was publicly owned. I felt it was a civilised form of transport. I wanted to be part of that. And to be fair, a lot of my colleagues, you know, in management, they were really into public service. You know, since privatisation, I think that's been diluted. There's still a lot of people in, you know, quote-unquote, the railway family that very much focused on public service. But, you know, especially initially after privatisation, people came in who'd been maybe selling tins of beans or toilet rolls and, you know, didn't have any affinity with the railway. Although, to be honest, I think when people join the railway, a lot of them start going native. They just get caught up in the whole business of this sort of parallel universe that the railway is.
Rail enthusiast David Spavin there, author of Scotland's Lost Branch Lines.
It was absolutely fascinating. I'm going to come clean here. I thought this was going to be quite a dry subject, but it's so integral into Scotland, our Scottish economy, our people, our future, our past. Brilliant story.
That's actually a key point in this, to my mind. People look at railways and they think in terms of tradition, you know, of history, of heritage and things like that. Railways are potentially the future. And I think that's something that people like David can see very clearly, and it's just a case of trying to get the politicians and the movers and shakers to agree with that. Let us know where you listen to this podcast. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. But from us, standing here on the railway platform, wondering when the next train's going to be, thanks for listening.